This is another in the series of shows that Voices put together in Pune. This one is created by Radhe Shyam, the president of Pune Temple. And the first three that we did, based on his slideshows, were Can a Scientist Believe in God? And then this one is called Getting the Eyes to See God. I went over it the other day, and there's some optical illusions in this one, and I didn't actually understand all of them, so I may be asking you to help me out with some of these optical illusions. I got some of them, but some of them are just beyond me. So if you rely on your senses to understand God, not only will you get just part of the picture, but it could cause problems. It's the old adage that a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing. You look at these various blind men, and the one's on his the elephant's back, and he's feeling the ear, which has a kind of a sharp edge, and so he's thinking some sort of a hatchet. Another blind man is feeling the point of the elephant's tusks, and he's thinking, well, it's like an arrow. It's like the tip of an arrow. Another man, he's feeling the trunk of the elephant. He's thinking, well, this feels like a snake. Another man is feeling the legs. He says it feels like a tree. Another man's latched onto the tail. He says it feels like a rope. I'm not sure what that guy is saying who's touching the torso. What is it? Oh, a brick wall. Okay. So everyone has their own story. Everyone has their own description of the elephant. And they seem contradictory. You know, like people say, well, which God do you worship? Or they talk about, well, this is a Christian God versus a Hindu God or a Muslim God, as if they were different gods. And in fact, the characteristics may seem to not be mutually inclusive, but rather different one from the other. But it's simply because God's so great, and we're blind. I mean, someone might say, well, what do you mean we're blind? You know, I can see perfectly well. I got 20/20 vision. But really, I mean, blind in the sense that, like a mole's not really blind. He just can't see very well. He can just, his range of sight is just like this. And our range of sight is greater. So we compared to what we can see, we say the mole is blind. He can see, but he can't see anything like what we can see. So we're blind also from other points of view. We close our eyes, we can't see anything, we can't see beyond this wall, we can't see beyond the Weiss. I've heard there's 500 miles of mountains just behind these mountains, between here and Denver, 500 miles of mountains. But I can't see them from where I'm standing right now. There's all kinds of mountains that I can't see. I can't see at night. But we are blind for all practical purposes. So if we each describe God according to our own experience, it'll be confusing at best, and it'll lead to conflict at worst. And so if what do the blind men do? I mean, what can they do to resolve the conflict? What would you think they would need to do? They know what they have a certain experience based on a limited sense, which doesn't include the eyes. They have a limited experience. They can describe what they're seeing, and they can imagine the rest. But it's going to be misleading. So if they want to see the object in its totality, if they actually want a cohesive, objective description of the elephant, which they can all then integrate their own experiences in and realize that they're all talking about the same thing and all get together and be peaceful and be happy and work well together instead of fighting and digging their heels in and insisting that their experience and their description is the best, what do they have to do? One simple thing. Huh? Nope, that won't even do it. Nope. I mean, that might be a start, you know, might be a start. It's like we say, well, there's Christians and Hindus, and we should learn to tolerate each other. We should learn to get along. We should learn to appreciate each other. But it doesn't always work. There's something more powerful that's needed. What do the blind men need? Huh? Yes, you agree? They need to access a person that can see. If these six blind men or 60 blind men or 600,000 blind men or 6 million blind men or 6 billion blind men, all they need is one man that can see. So that's the problem. People are they're attached They have their own conception of God. They're attached to it. They think they're right. Everybody's wrong. And the problem is that there isn't anybody who actually sees. There isn't any clairvoyant, pure devotee that can resolve these kinds of conflicts for people. And so there's three ways of gaining knowledge, as we're going to talk about today. That's what this talk emphasizes. They're called prachaksha praman, which means direct sense perception, just what you can directly perceive, and not interpolating anything beyond that. Just sticking, like they say, just the facts, man. Just stick to the facts. And then there's anumana praman, theories based on evidence. In other words, you have a certain amount of evidence which points to some conclusions. You may not be able to directly experience those conclusions with your limited senses, but the evidence all seems to point to it. And so, therefore, you'll go with those conclusions until the evidence points somewhere else or there's more evidence which adds to it. And then there is Sabda Brahman. Sabda Brahman means, it's just, Sabda Brahman is like the sixth blind man taking advantage of what a sighted man can see. And so these are the different three ways of acquiring knowledge. For instance, nobody's seen an atom. Nobody's seen an atom, but there's enough information about that we can basically sort of put together the idea of an atom. And it's changing. I mean, there's even subatomic particles, there's string theory now, all based on inference, all based on anumana praman, theories based on evidence. We also can compile statistics and arrive at a theory. There's a Kepler theory. I don't know what it is, but there's a Kepler theory. There's an Avogadro theory, which is based on statistical evidence. But our process of acquiring knowledge is called Sabda Brahman, and it involves hearing from authority. Last Sunday, we gave the example that if you were born and your father had left and you never saw your father. So when you're 10 or 12 or 14 or 16 years old, some man comes walking through the door and he says, "I'm your dad." How are you going to determine whether what he's saying is true or not? You can see him, you can taste him, you can touch him, you can smell him, but you don't know whether he's lying to you or not. What's the only way you can for sure undoubtedly verify that this man is your father? It's not through your own personal research, really. What's the only way you can verify whether this man is telling the truth?
Ask your mom.
Ask your mom. Yeah, she knows. Let's put it this way. If she doesn't know, you know, you're not going to find out. So the father is Krishna, father is God, and the mom are the scriptures. The Vedic scriptures are compared to the mother that can give us information of where it is that we come from and give us information who, in fact, is the organizer, who, in fact, is the designer, and is the controller. And you see these little graphics here. On the left, here's the mad scientist with the ruffled hair, you know, pouring stuff from beaker to beaker. And it's obviously not a calming, peaceful experience. On the right-hand side, you see a teacher, a saintly, holy man, and you see the students, which may very well be Krishna and Balaram, and they're just hearing from him what he's heard from his guru, what he's heard from his guru, what he's heard from his guru, what he's heard from his guru. And the original speaker was God. And God is in perfect knowledge, and he speaks perfectly. And if that knowledge is passed down into civil succession with integrity, without additions and editing and subtracting, then we can receive perfect knowledge even thousands and thousands and thousands of years into the creation. So the question is, prachaksa praman. Prachaksa praman, that is direct sense perception basically means, if I can't see it, I won't believe it. If I can't see it, I won't believe it. And the flip side of that is what? If I can't see it, I won't believe it. And what's the flip side of it is?
If I can see it, it's real.
If I can see it, it's real. Okay, now I don't understand. I warned you. I don't understand all these little visual tricks here. But I do understand the one in the top left. Okay? I do. Now what we're seeing there is a crooked straw. Isn't it? What we're seeing is a crooked straw. But is the straw actually crooked? Well, it might be or it might not, but I don't think it's crooked. It's just the way the shadow reflects on the water. It looks crooked. So that's what we're seeing, and what we're seeing is not right. What we're seeing is not right. We're seeing a crooked straw, but the straw is not crooked. Now, does anyone want to help me out with these other two images? I spent like 50... Huh? Oh, yeah, okay. Well, thank you very much. Here, he's right-handed, right? Here, he's left-handed. He's left-handed. So you're seeing a left-handed man in the mirror, but he's not left-handed. So if seeing is believing, that's going to be misleading. Things that we see, but we don't believe, things that we believe, but we don't see. Relative truth is always changing. So those are things that we see, and if our credo is that what I see, I believe, then you're seeing illusion here. You're not seeing reality. So here are the problems by relying upon our senses. What are the pitfalls that we get into when we rely on our senses? There are four pitfalls which prevents conclusions arrived at through direct sense perception, which prevents them from being perfect. They're always fallible because we suffer from four fallibilities. And what are those four defects? One is imperfect senses. The other one is to be illusioned. The other is tendency to commit mistakes. And the fourth is cheating propensity. Let's repeat those because these are really good to keep in mind. One is imperfect senses. Two is to be illusioned. Three is the tendency to commit mistakes, and four is the cheating propensity. That's your homework. That's your homework. Those of you who are going to come back next week, you need to be able to recite those four defects. And if possible, give examples of them, which are forthcoming. The first of those four defects is that we have imperfect senses. Our eyes are blind outside the range of 400 to 700 millimicron. Millimicron. You know what those are, Jerry? Millimicrons?
Something really small.
Something really small. Really small. So our range is like 300 millimicrons. And presumably lower than 400, well, lower than 400, there's probably about 400 millimicrons below that. And above 700, we don't know. There's probably many, many, many. Here's the range of our ears, from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. Dogs, you know, will blow a whistle that we can't even hear, and it's driving the dogs nuts. They're howling and running around in circles and doing all kinds of things. So I don't know exactly how to characterize these limitations, but obviously they're significant. We have a limited range of sensual perception. And here's some other indications. The scientists say, well, we will compensate for the weakness of our senses, our seeing, smelling, tasting, and hearing. We will compensate that by building powerful instruments, like, for instance, a telescope. And the telescope will increase the range of things that we see. There's only one problem with that. What is that problem? Huh? You have to use your eye to look through the telescope. Telescope is going to, they say, oh, magnify it, but you're using your eye to look through the telescope. Or something that you can hear. You know, these private investigators or the military, you know, the secret ops guys, they have things that they can, you know, hear a conversation between two suspected spies, you know, like a half a mile away or something like that. But the problem is you're still processing it with these ears here. You can't get away from it. These four defects are common to embodied beings. When you have a body, you have eyes, ears, nose, smell, and sense, and they're limited. And no matter how much you try to magnify those, you still can't get away from the fact that you're going to have to process all that information through those limited senses. Nobel Prize winning physicist Eugene Wigner points out, quote, even if we photograph stars, eventually we have to take in by our senses what the photo shows. Furthermore, without our senses, we cannot handle a camera. Even if we amplified / refined by instruments, the knowledge is no more perfect than our imperfect senses. Okay, well, did that make everyone happy there? Was there a point to that? All right, so imperfect senses. The second one is to be illusioned. If you hear something hissing, you may think it's a cooker, but actually it's a train. You may think it's a train, but actually it's a cooker. You see something wiggling in the grass, you're walking at night, and you go, a snake. And then you realize it's actually a rope. Another evening, you're walking in the grass, and you see something wiggling, and you think it's just a rope, and you walk past it and bites you, and you die, because it wasn't a rope, it was a cobra. See what I'm saying? So we can be illusion. We can mistake a rope for a snake. We can mistake a snake for a rope. Now, here's some examples of illusion. If you eat an orange, if you eat sugar, and then you eat an orange, the orange tastes sour. Did you know that? If you eat sugar first and then you eat an orange, the orange tastes sour. Now, if you eat a lemon first and then you take an orange afterwards, the orange tastes sweet, even sweeter than it would normally taste. Another example is
if
it's cold, how is that working? Huh? How, what is this? Explain this to me. If your hand's warm and you touch water, it feels cool. If your hand's cold and you touch water, it feels warm. Okay. Oh, it's the same water, same temperature, but with a warm hand, it feels cold. With a cold hand, it feels warm. Good. All right. See, I'm imperfect and my senses are illusion. Yeah. So guess what truth can you see in darkness? We're basically in darkness all the time. We think that there's a daytime period and we think there's a darkness period. But when you consider how limited our senses, we're basically always in darkness. The difference between our daytime and darkness, you see, and what's really going on out there is the difference between our daytime and darkness is insignificant compared to the difference between both our daytime and our night times and what's really going out there. Like a dog, for instance, they can smell 20 million scents. They can smell 20 million scents. For the dog to walk here from here to the gate, it's like us reading the Mahabharata, you know? It's like us reading the Mahabharata, you know? It's like 5,000 episodes of CSI. You know what I'm saying? So the difference between our day and night is not that much difference. You know, what more we can perceive during the day is just not that much greater than at night. And when you compare either one of those or both of those with what's out there, then you have a huge, like a Grand Canyon worth of difference. So we're really just always in the dark. We're always in the dark. You know, you talk about someone, you know, well, he doesn't have a clue. Well, none of us really have a clue if we're relying on our senses. Not only do we have a clue, but we'll see things and believe things which are misleading. For instance, if you look at the sun, how big would you think the sun was? If you were just relying upon your own sense perception. Yeah, size of a quarter, it might be 5 miles wide, it might be 100 miles away. You know, that's what you think. So if seeing is believing, then you would believe something totally erroneous about the sun. When the sun rises, the darkness is dispelled. When perfect knowledge is obtained, all illusion is also dispelled. Okay, so these are the pictures. Some of them I understand them, some of them I don't. Some of them, it just involves looking at them and seeing what the optical illusions are. Okay. Now look at these pictures and tell me what you see. You should be able to see two things from each picture. Now in figure 3, do you see two old people looking at each other?
Yeah.
Do you also see a Mexican lady and a Mexican man sitting side by side with their little hut behind them? And the man's playing a guitar. And the woman's holding something on her head.
Yeah.
You see that? Okay. Okay. Now, figure 2, what do you see? Young or old? See a young woman looking away, right? Kind of looking back over her right shoulder. Do you see the young woman looking back over her right shoulder? Does anyone see an old woman? See an old woman, right? I've done it in the past. I've seen the old woman in the past. I can't see her right now, but... Where is it?
That's her nose. That's her mouth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's her chin. That's her nose.
Yeah. I still don't see it.
Over her head. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Now, what about figure one? All I see is a bunch of...
This is also a face.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Figure one is a triangle and it's got a little...
Triangle and three dots.
A triangle and three dots. Okay. All right. So, obviously, we can see it in many, many, many different ways. Now, this one, I think you're supposed to... What are you supposed to do with this one?
It's curved.
It looks curved. Yeah, it looks like cylinders, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Standing on top. Looks like a bunch of... It's kind of undulating. When you look at it for a long time, it kind of undulates. Now, this one, I don't understand this one, but it says these guys are all the same height. Can anyone explain how that can be? Huh? Because the floor is going up? It's going up?
No, the wall behind was in perspective. And so that guy...
Oh, I see.
If that's the top of his head, this guy's head should be where his hand is.
Yeah.
Because of getting smaller. But they made the three figures the same height, so it's out of perspective. So therefore he looks bigger.
Okay.
It's okay. Kind of like a camera, you know? You can make the room look a lot bigger,
smaller. Okay. So that's just the zoom effect there.
Well, it's not even using the zoom. It's where you are in the room when you take the picture and the angle that you take the picture in.
Okay. All right. What's next? Oh, yeah. This one, if you just look at the dot in the center, if you stare at the dot in the center, and then move your head backwards and forwards. Move your head backwards and forwards. The inside, when you go forward, the inside will rotate to the left, and when you go back, the inside will rotate to the right. Do you see that? I'm not getting the outside, but I'm getting the inside rotating. Anyone getting the outside rotating? Oh, yeah, there goes the outside. There goes the outside. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. What else? Okay, what are we supposed to see from here? Huh? They all look like they're moving. Yeah, they do. Okay. Okay, here's ships in the foreground, and it looks like a bridge or arches with clouds behind them. The further away you get. Is that correct? Anyone see anything else in there? See the arches? See the ships? All right. Okay, so what two defects did we cover so far?
Perfect senses and illusion.
And what two do we have yet to go?
Mistakes and cheating.
Okay, to commit mistakes is the third of the four defects. One time, brain was thought of as an organ to cool the blood. That's what science thought of the brain at one point. They considered the pituitary or master glands were a vestige or useless tissue in the body because they believed in evolution. So they believed that certain components of the body were no longer necessary, which is in fact was fatally incorrect, you know. Three astronomers recently discovered a significant mistake in the Hubble constant, which is a value used as a cosmic yardstick to measure enormous distances in the universe. So the distances that they'd once thought were so are no longer that way. Well, that we didn't spend much time in committing mistakes. Did we? All right. Here's cheating propensity. Of course, at one point, the missing link was put forward. The Piltdown Man was discovered, I believe, in Africa. And everyone heralded this as the missing link. But then when they investigated, and that was actually accepted, I believe, for a number of years. There were actually textbooks written to show this is the missing link between ape and between man. And finally, when someone looked into it enough, sufficiently, they realized that it was the jawbone of a pig or a deer or something. It wasn't even a human remains. That was in 1912 when that particular missing link was discovered to be a fraud. And then in 1953, the fraud was revealed. I think these are two different attempts to try and provide the missing link. One was debunked in 1912 and the other one in 1953 there. I've got some notes here. Let me just see what these notes say. Okay. All right, I guess that deals with the direct perception and the problems with direct perception. And our next category of knowledge acquisition is called anumana praman. And those are theories based on evidence. And those, based on what we know, we make theories about what we don't know. And in this area, we get a lot of words like, I believe, it could have been, maybe, perhaps, might, like that. Prabhupada used to say, if you want to talk in those terms, maybe, might, perhaps, could have been, or I think, or I suppose, he says, go into a closet. Because it's just speculating. It's speculating on the basis of imperfect senses, making imperfect conclusions from experiences done by imperfect senses, like that. And it's mentioned here that Darwin never talked about how the initial species were created. He never talked about how all this evolutionary process got started. There was a theory called the spontaneous generation theory, where it somehow or other everything got jump-started somehow or other. How, we don't know, but that's a convenient way of explaining what you don't know. Hoyle said that even if the whole universe is filled with primordial soup, there is no possibility of life generation. It's 1 to the 10 by 40,000 powers. The chance of even one cell being created spontaneously. 1 by 10 to the 40,000 powers of one cell. And yet life had to have been created spontaneously and simultaneously with gazillions and gazillions and gazillions of worth of cells at the same time. Here it says that with as many elements of a primordial soup as there would exist in the whole universe, the chance of getting one particle of life spontaneously is longer than the life of the universe itself. So, what else have we got here? These are some quotes that Darwin wrote to A.R. Wallace in 1857. I'm a firm believer that without speculation, there's no good in original observation. So here's the model for anumana, the inference, the getting knowledge by inference. After 5 years' work, I allowed myself to speculate on the subject and drew up some short notes. These I enlarged in 1844 into a sketch of the conclusions which seemed to me probable, and that was the origin of the species. In North America, the black bear was seen swimming for hours with wide open mouth, thus catching, like a whale, insects in water. Even in so extreme a case as this, if the supply of insects were constant and if better adapted competitors did already exist in the country, I can see no difficulty in a race of bears by natural selection, more and more aquatic in their structure and habits, with larger and larger mouths, till the creature was produced as monstrous as a whale. There's only one problem. How did the bear learn to swim and to live in water? This is a land animal going into the water for short periods of time, swimming with his mouth wide open. How did he transfer to be able to live within the water? How did he get fins? In other words, what's your explanation that his legs became fins? Now even Darwin admits, based on what we know, The idea of the eye having evolved, Darwin himself said, it's absurd in the highest degree. In most cases, for working senses like eyes and joints and things that involve some degree of sophistication, it's not that just one occurrence has to happen to bring this into being. There are literally hundreds of thousands of simultaneous occurrences that have had to happen. It's like trying to bring this building into being by an explosion, by putting dynamite and building materials and blowing it up. How many times would you have to blow it up to get just this exact building? It's not one instance, but it's literally, I mean, how many hundreds of each tile, each particle of paint, each crystal in the chandelier. I mean, it's just, there's no way that could have ever been spontaneously generated. If you talk about a person laying the tiles, putting the crystals together, handling the crystals, painting the walls, that makes the most perfect sense in the world. And we have experience of that every day. My Bobby just brought in someone to fix the air conditioner. There's another guy down there digging up to his waist to resuscitate the sprinkler systems. I mean, that's the way things happen by people. But if you're talking about, say, a building, and a building isn't even 1/1,000,000,000th as complicated as a cell. This building, with all the plumbing, electricity, wiring, everything, doesn't even begin to touch the complication of a single cell. And could this building ever be, to have this building come into being, you see, by accident, would literally require hundreds of thousands of things to happen simultaneously. And not even one of those things is likely to happen. What to speak of hundreds of thousands of things to get a completed working thing. And so Darwin knew that, at least in the case of the eye, he admitted that there's no way that something as sophisticated as the eye and all that it involves could have happened by evolution. Now here's the record of the rocks, and you go back 2 million years ago, and you've got Neanderthal-looking people, but then you've also got a pretty good-looking, modern-looking guy there 2 million years ago. And 400,000 years ago, you've also got your monkey guy, but you've also got a pretty civilized, contemporary-looking guy, as you do also between 100,000 years and 40,000 years. A lot of this information comes from the work of Michael Cremo and Sataputta Das, Richard Thompson, who wrote Forbidden Archaeology. And they have discovered many, many instances where scientific information has been repressed, which seems to throw doubt on the theory of evolution or Darwinism. The fact is that for every Neanderthal looking like fossil, there's a contemporary skeletal structure that's been found as well. So if you want to argue that the further you go back in time, the more primitive people were, you have problems. The record of the rock doesn't bear that out. And if you want to look at our modern society, if you think Neanderthal people only existed millions and millions of years ago, just go to New York City. There's plenty of them walking the streets of New York City. Just like these skulls here. The collapse of Darwinism. So there are two more questions than answers in Darwinism. Now here's our process called Sabda Brahman. It's civilized. It's free from stress. It's free from worry. It's free from the defects of cheating, illusion, making mistakes, and imperfect senses, because it originates with God, and He suffers from none of those defects. Krishna originally speaks to Lord Brahma. Brahma speaks to Naradaji. Narada speaks to Vyasadeva. And then the knowledge comes down, and each member, each chain, each link in that chain of the civic session is not self-interested or self-motivated. His or her only business is to pass down the knowledge as they received it in disciplic succession. So here you have it, as I mentioned it, and through from Narada, it goes to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna describes the system for acquiring knowledge. Evam parampara praptim imam rijarshya vidu sakalinena mahata mahakalinena mahasada. It's called parampara. And Krishna says, originally I spoke this science to the great kings and to the great demigods, and they in turn passed it down through the various ages. So if you don't know the truth, and we don't know the truth, and we can't deduce the truth with our limited senses and our mental speculation, then we need to approach someone who has not those four defects. We need to approach someone who knows the truth. Just like going back to the original slide, if the six blind men can't agree on what an elephant is, then all they have to do is approach someone that can see and get a full and comprehensive description of the elephant. Because the person who can see is not suffering from the defect that prohibits them from getting perfect knowledge. So God is not suffering from our four defects. And so unless we avail ourselves of the knowledge coming down from God into succession, we will all have different ideas of what the truth is, different opinions, and we'll never live happily and peacefully together. So how can we understand the Supreme Person who is the creator of infinite, gigantic universes, and who, in the beginning of creation, tene brahmavida adi kivayat mayanti yat suriho. And in the beginning of creation, as we know, Lord Brahma was seated atop of his lotus flower. He was all alone. There was nothing but darkness around him. And he wanted to access the knowledge with which he would then begin to create the universe. And so he did austerities for 1,000 years. He did tapasya, at the end of which the Lord appeared before him and imparted into the heart of Lord Brahma not only the knowledge of how to create the universe, but also the spiritual knowledge as well. So that as Lord Brahma creates the universe, he also is charged with keeping alive the knowledge whereby souls can get liberated from the universe. The example is given, when this computer is manufactured, there's also an instruction booklet produced along with the computer, so you'll know how to use it. So the instruction booklet, which is produced along with this universe, is the Vedas. And by following the Vedas, we can learn to live in the world and at the end of life, go back home, back to God, and extricate ourselves from this world. Because this world is not our home. The only purpose of this world is to rehabilitate us so we get back home, back to Godhead. So how do we know that the Lord does not have flaws? We know from his creation. This is the fourth in a series of shows. And over and over and over again, we've given examples in the first series about how it is a scientist can believe in God, of the perfection, of the precision with it, which this whole universe is running. You remember all those different detailed descriptions of the perfection and the flawlessness with which this creation is working. In fact, if there's any anomalies, if there's anything wrong, you can bet your bottom dollars because of man meddling around, you see, with what was really a perfect arrangement. And so we can understand that the Creator is flawless because the creation is also flawless. Like when you use a Macintosh computer and you use it for a long time and it's friendly and it's easy to use and it does all, then you get, you know, pretty good healthy respect for the Steve Jobs and his friends in Carpinteria. You see what I'm saying? So similarly, if you really look around this universe and marvel at its organization, its precision, its perfection, then you'll know that who created it is also perfect. So this knowledge was revealed by that person within the heart of the first created living being, and thus you see the image here, how it is it comes down from guru to disciple to the present day. We've used the example many times before that if you pick a mango from the tree and you want it to reach the bottom unbruised, then you'll pass it down. You'll have a bunch of climbers going up at various stages and you'll hand it down from one to another and that'll reach the bottom unbruised and perfectly delectable and edible. You don't just throw it down. So the defect, the problem with people in this age is that they are this, and I think we'll end with this. And we may be able to have, I think, enough slides to have a part two of this next week. I didn't realize. It's already 7 o'clock. Isn't it amazing? Time flies, huh? In fact, why don't we start next week with this verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Praying alpayusha shabda kaloish minyugejana mandasa mandateo mandahi patadridaha. The special disqualifications of the living beings in this degraded age of Kali, and how much more we need to, or how much greater is the advantage which presents itself before us in the Kali Yuga age, that we imperfect creatures with short lifespans and not a very sharp intellect and being lazy and misguided, that we can still acquire perfect knowledge if we use this simple mechanism of the disciplic accession. So we'll stop there this time.